final discussant is Professor Donald Harris from Stanford University.
I shall try to address some of the issues that the previous two speakers have raised by posing some questions of my own that I consider rather intriguing, in the hope that by so doing I could bring out some more general issues that lie behind the arguments and positions that they've taken. First of all, let me begin by saying that one striking thing to me about the so-called debt crisis is the striking amount of public attention it has received. Judging, for instance, from the amount of newsprint and other coverage by the media that has been devoted to it, I would say it ranks second only to the coverage given to Glasnost, Perestroika, and Gorbachev. And in the last 6 months, one might even say that the noise has risen to a crescendo. This, I think, is an important problem in itself to explain, namely, why all this attention? Professor Sachs gave one answer to that question. I have a rather different view, which I hope to indicate as I go along in telling my own story. I think some important clues to the answer can be found in, of all places, the Wall Street Journal, which in these matters is quite perceptive, one might say, in the degree to which they evidently have communications with the inner sanctuary of the boardrooms of the various banks and corporate structures. The Wall Street Journal, in an article on June 30th, 1983, entitled Money and Power, Future Political Effects of Foreign Debt Crisis Worry Some Observers, the author of that article explains that the debt crisis and the solutions being put in place could have significant long-term political implications. They may, among other things, increase government involvement in the private sector in developing nations, awful consequence, I might add, parenthetically, reduce a trend toward a more integrated world economy, and give ammunition to foreign politicians looking to attack policies of the industrial countries. It may also reduce United States political leverage overseas. The article goes on to add that the foreign banks' high visibility in the debt crisis also has begun to create a political backlash against them in developing countries. Increasingly, banks are perceived as the bad guys, demanding tough economic changes and withholding vital foreign exchange. A U.S. banker in Latin America recently grew a beard. When asked why, he replied, for protective coloring. On March 9th, 1989, which is 6 years after that piece that I just quoted from, the Wall Street Journal is again on top of the issue, and it says in rather straightforward and bold type, "While the Bush administration searches for a new U.S. policy on third world debt, the red ink is turning to blood. More than 300 people recently died in riots in Venezuela, where the government had imposed tough austerity measures to please its creditors." Further down in the article, the author points out that the Treasury has reached its present conclusion, namely the conclusion surrounding the Brady Plan, against a backdrop of discouraging political developments. In Argentina, a nationalist right-wing party appears set to win pending elections. In Brazil, two anti-US leftist parties have rebounded. In Mexico, late last year, the opposition party held Mr. Salinas to the ruling party's smallest margin of victory in 50 years. I think that there's a great deal of perceptiveness in these articles as to what lies behind the concerns and the rather vigorous concerns that we hear in the media about the debt crisis. That was not intended for the previous speakers.
I want you to stop.
My own view is that there's much more to the picture than this, and that in a sense the Wall Street Journal has merely picked up the tip of the iceberg, and there's in the story that I shall tell, something that will indicate how I would rather seek to construct this analysis. I forewarn you that There's nothing in what I have to say here that implies any kind of conspiracy going on in the background. It's all straightforwardly interpretable, I think, in terms of the logic of financial markets, and in particular, the peculiar role of the banks in this story. What is interesting also to me, quite apart from this first question of the enormous amount of public attention given to the issue, is that it is not the first time that the world economy has gone through a wrenching debt crisis of this sort. And in fact, it has gone through worse debt crises, in particular the crisis of the 1930s. But before that, there was the crisis of the 1820s, crisis of the 1870s, crisis of the 1890s. The 1930s crisis was perhaps the most severe because, as we know, at least two-thirds of private portfolio investment went into default in that period. And in that respect, then, the 1930s really constitute the most dramatic and generalized instance. But I would regard this as an instance of a recurrent phenomenon and not an isolated one. The point about the historical evidence also, as is clear from various studies done recently by Eichen, Green, Porters, and others, is that there are certain basic ingredients of the kind of financial crisis that we are witnessing today that have not changed much in all of the previous episodes. First of all, that they were linked to disturbances in the world economy associated with interest rate shocks, commodity price fluctuations, and so on, as well as severe recessions in the leading countries which spilled over on debtor countries. Creditors criticized always for reckless lending, and in most cases that reckless lending is ascribed to myopia or to excessive competition. Furthermore, in my view, a terribly interesting and intriguing point is that there's very little evidence of what's called default penalty in the sense of reduced access to international capital markets for the countries that went into default. Quite often, it's clear, and this is sharply revealed in the evidence of Eichen Green, that defaulting debtors were able to re-enter international capital markets only to default again. Finally, a striking feature of the historical episodes is that capital markets do not repair themselves quickly, nor spontaneously. They typically repair themselves only after a phase of systematic outside intervention by government and international institutions. Now, history in that sense is very revealing, and I think the real problem is to identify to what extent, if in any serious qualitative way, is the current crisis significantly different from the historical episodes that we've witnessed before. I think certainly there are differences, and that those differences are largely associated with the changes that have occurred in the interim, certainly since 1930, in the structure of international lending and in the character of international financial institutions. But it's not clear to me that the formula for resolving these crises has drastically changed, and that in fact we will not witness, as we are beginning to see, and this is in fact the inference that I draw from what Professor Sachs calls a turnaround in the IMF. The IMF is coming to see, albeit after a six-year lag, that there's a necessary role in this process for writing off the debt, as is clearly the practice in most banking situations where the rational policy of the bank, when you run into a bad debt, is to write it off. Now, this raises for me another intriguing question, which I'll pose, about the current episode, which is why haven't the debtors, at least the larger ones, sought to exercise or use the threat of unilateral partial repudiation to push the banks into a position of making greater concessions? One would have thought, certainly, that from a game theoretic point of view, the larger debtors like Argentina, Brazil, Mexico, and so on, would be in an ideal position to do this. For principles and reasons that are well known in the financial textbooks, by the way, including a remarkably good paper on this by Gershovitz in 1985, where Gershovitz shows that even in the presence of rising marginal cost of funds, an exposed bank will continue to offer new lending because of the nature of the situation between lender and borrower. But in fact, this has not happened. The debtor countries have not used what evidently is, from a strategic point of view, a very powerful threat. It is rather the banks themselves who have emerged from the situation, not only with the upper hand in negotiations, but smelling rosier than ever from each debt restructuring agreement, given the amount of commissions that they get on those agreements, and given the fact that they turn out, at least in a short-term sense, to get from those agreements a substantial amount of repayment of interest. And there have been over 90 such agreements, by the way, since 1982, in almost all of which the banks, I would argue, have emerged quite well off. The reason why this has not happened, why the debtor countries have failed to exercise what may be considered to constitute a powerful threat, has a lot to do with the structure of international financial markets, and in particular with the fact that the big banks are able clearly to organize a kind of coalition that is stronger and more united than any possible coalition that can emerge among the big debtors, as big as they happen to be. Nevertheless, the coalition of the bankers can always, in a sense, outdo them by effectively blocking any strategy of use of this weapon. Secondly, it's clear that the big banks have been aided in this counter strategy by the international lending institutions because of the very point that Professor Sachs pointed out, namely they have insisted on dealing with banks on a case-by-case basis, so that the possibility of collusion among dealing with the debtor countries, I'm sorry, on a case-by-case basis, so that the possibility of collusion among them is thereby forestalled. Now, this brings me finally then to the question of the role of the banks. And here there's no question but that the banks have played a key role. I think everybody is in reasonable agreement about this. Some commentators go so far as to single out the banks for special criticism as the villains of the piece. For instance, Bernard Lewis, the well-known historian of the Ottoman debt crisis in the 1870s, points out that what remains constant across a century of history is the inexperience of the borrowers and the rapacity of the lenders. In a similar vein, a well-known Harvard economist refers to them as Robin Hoods. I think you will get the pun. It was certainly a well-conceived title and a rather neatly, in my judgment, expressed point of view. This is the title of an article, for those of you who haven't seen it, in the New Republic of March 13, 1989, by Professor Sachs. Now, far be it from me, in the light of this concerted attack on the rapacity of the banks, to come here and appear before you and try to defend the banks. But I would rather like to suggest that this position, the position of attacking the banks for their rapacity, or for being Robin Hoods, as the case may be, is in danger of being terribly misleading, and in some respects may be considered to rather badly miss the point. I think the problem really requires more careful scrutiny and analysis, and in the brief time that I have here, I'll try to suggest what my view on the problem is. I want to leave aside, first of all, the question of their greed or their rapacity, because I don't think that that criterion suffices to distinguish them as especially different and unique, certainly not among other operators in the financial system or other corporations, for that matter. And banks are, after all, corporations. I think we should never forget that. And that really is my point that I want to emphasize, that banks must be and can be relied upon to do as bankers do, which is to say, distort a rather well-known phrase of Gertrude Stein, that banks are banks are banks. In particular, they must be expected to, each and every one of them, to maximize the value of their shareholders' equity and to strive to do as best they can within the constraints that they face. And in the general context, which we well know of from the textbooks as well as from the daily press, of an environment in which there is a high degree of risk and uncertainty, problems that are referred to in the literature as lack of deposit insurance, as well as the recurrence of macroeconomic shocks over which the banks themselves as individual agencies have no direct and immediate control. Thirdly, I would like to point out, since in fact it seems to be a matter worth emphasizing, that there is no evidence that the banks acted irrationally from the standpoint of the normal criteria of individual profit maximization. This is certainly the influence that the inference that I draw, for instance, from the studies of Shuli Usler and Sebastian Edwards and others, which indicate that the experience level of a borrower contributes significantly to the variation in spreads, and hence that spreads are directly correlated then with the level of experience of borrowers. This seems to me to indicate quite clearly that banks do take into account the track record, so to speak, of performance in judging and evaluating the kinds of projects that are presented to them. If anything, the problem for the banks in this period, it seems to me, was that in moving heavily into the arena of international lending to national governments, they had to face head-on problems that are intrinsic to the area of sovereign debt as such, and for which in fact the individual banks have no individual solution. I would only quickly refer you here, because I don't have time to go into the theoretical literature, to the work of people like Eaton, Gersowitz, Stiglitz, Weiss, and so on, who point out that it's extraordinarily difficult to define, in the context of lending to sovereign borrowers, what one means by an appropriate credit ceiling or the optimal amount of lending. Furthermore, issues of insolvency and illiquidity become very blurred at the margin when thinking about loans to sovereign governments. And in fact, some of these authors judge that insolvency and illiquidity is not really an issue in lending to foreign governments. Lying behind this argument is of course, the idea that there are intrinsic problems of adverse selection and moral hazard and monitoring and so on in the international arena when dealing with foreign governments. I would take the argument much further myself in thinking of the financial system as an intrinsically unstable mechanism, which even if there exists an equilibrium, that equilibrium, there may be multiple equilibria, and much of the current theorizing has shown that. Furthermore, that there are intrinsic problems of runaway of the financial system, given the ability on the part of banks to always introduce all sorts of innovations that undermine the stability of any stability previously achieved on the basis of previous set of financial instruments. The work of Minsky and others are, I think, relevant in assessing this rather abstract position. Now, in this light, then, I think we can view the charges that are being leveled against the banks and the view of the banks as being the villains of the piece as really stemming from the view that they overemphasize short-run profit maximization, and secondly, that this may be at the expense of their long-run position, that in a sense, the banks are insisting on their pound of flesh, ignoring that the patient may die in the interim. In other words, to put the issue even more starkly, I think the position of bashing the banks comes from a view that there's a fundamental contradiction between their private individual greed, what I'm calling here short-run profit maximization, and their long-term collective self-interest. And it is only from this position, really, that one can get the policy inference that many of these critics recommend, namely that the bank should cut their losses now by accepting a substantial amount of debt relief or debt reduction, as the case may be, rather than delay and take a bigger loss later on. Hence the emphasis then on the necessity for an immediate and sharp cut in the amount of outstanding debt. I think that in the light of the position that I'm presenting here, this recommendation must be seen to be noteworthy for the fact that it comes out on the side of the collective interest of the banks, as distinct from their individual, greedy, short-run profit maximization interest, and as distinct, therefore, from their short-sightedness in seeking to squeeze as much as they can by insisting on repayment now. Whereas, in other words, the tendency is to view this position as being on the side of the angels, namely the debtor countries. I'm saying that it is really a position that is dramatically geared to optimizing the long run position of the banks as a group. It is interesting also, I think, that the position of bashing the banks has obviously aroused the deep suspicion and resentment of the banks. In fact, perhaps some of the economists who have taken this position in public and are well known to have taken this position should themselves be wearing in public beards so as to protect themselves with protective coloring from the bankers. Because the bankers have been rather vituperative in expressing their resentment against those who have sought to criticize them in this way. My view is that this position of the banks is not at all surprising, because the banks have proved themselves in this long history of debt crises that I mentioned before, first of all, to be better able to understand their true long-run position than these commentators and critics admit, and secondly, that they're in a better position to maximize their long-run profits than these commentators admit. My interpretation of the strategy of the banks can be put rather straightforwardly. Hold out for full debt repayment now, while engaging in a lot of public relations about voluntary debt relief so as to take the pressure off and make yourselves appear to be quite rosy. In the meantime, allow public pressure to build up so as to force the government and the international banks to come to the rescue of the banks. This strategy, I think, has paid off handsomely, and this precisely is how I interpret the Brady Plan, that it comes at a time when enough public pressure has been built up as a result of all the media attention that has been given and all of the resentment that has been aroused to get the government, the federal government, in this case the Treasury Department, to do something about the problem. And in this respect, furthermore, an implication of my argument must be seen to be that the pressure for debt relief or debt reduction plays very much into the hands of the banks, because it is that pressure which generates pressure on the part of the Treasury and on the part of the international institutions like the IMF and the World Bank to come to the rescue of the banks by offering to give them to the commercial banks with one hand what they take from the taxpayers in the other hand. A position which has been well portrayed, I think, by Professor Sachs. And it is in this respect I see the significance of the media attention that I outlined at the outset of my discussion here. The trouble with the emphasis on debt relief and with the focus on debt reduction as a singular issue, so to speak, is twofold. First of all, it says nothing about the conditions under which the debtor countries will emerge from the crisis once it is resolved in this way. In other words, once we have had the debt reduction and the writing off of the debts by whatever technical means I'm not going into at this point, what happens then? I fear that it may very well happen that the debtor countries will emerge in a position of being further and more deeply entrenched in the supervisory and monitoring and disciplining mechanisms that the international banking system has for keeping them in line. And this is clearly what the IMF, for instance, is insisting on. In yesterday's Wall Street Journal, the IMF was described as insisting on the necessity for accompanying any intervention to provide debt relief with measures that systematically require restructuring and structural readjustment in these economies. And I think the IMF's understanding of structural readjustment is unique to the IMF and certainly need not serve the interests of the debtor countries. Secondly, I think that this position is troublesome, the position of focusing on debt relief as a singular aspect of the problem, because it does nothing to address the really crucial long-term problem that the world economy faces in the context of the debt crisis, and a problem which is very sharply revealed by going back into the scrutiny, I think, of the historical analysis that has been done, namely that after all of these major episodes in the past in which there was a substantial debt crisis, the world economy went into a period of sustained recession or stagnation following the resolution of the crisis. Were it not for the systematic intervention of the international lending institutions or of the collective action of various governments. Instructive in this respect, I think, is the recognition that after the crisis in the First World War, in the decade following the First World War, it was the so-called Dawes loan, which really served by providing a massive amount of liquidity in the system to forestall the possibilities of a recession coming from the transfer and reparations payments. Secondly, in the decade after World War II, it was the Marshall Plan that really provided the mechanism to stimulate the recovery of the international system through both trade and investment after the devastating consequences of the 1930s default occurred. What then I'd like to conclude by saying is that we have to think more imaginatively and creatively about the debt situation rather than focusing on these single unilinear views about the situation. We need, first of all, a large-scale stimulus, and that is clearly what I infer from, for instance, the role that the Marshall Plan played in restoring the international trade system and investment after the war. And the large-scale intervention that I'm thinking of here would go beyond debt relief. Debt relief is itself a form of substantial intervention if it is accompanied by a 50% write-off of debt, which essentially acknowledges that there's a 50% free transfer of credit to the debtor countries. So substantial debt reduction would necessarily have to be a part of such a broadly based strategy, but it would have to be accompanied by new loans and grants as well, on a much larger scale. It would have to be accompanied by an across-the-board cut in interest rates, as well as by technical assistance programs that would allow a freer transfer of technology to the underdeveloped countries so they can catch up on the substantial technology gap that inhibits their industrialization effort. And finally, it would have to be accompanied as well by the substantial opening up of markets to trade that would allow the debtor countries to realize the possibility of payback through gaining export surpluses. Of course, we know that that essentially means allowing a kind of beggar thy neighbor policies on the part of the debtor countries. And that in itself indicates why there's so much resistance to this idea of opening up markets to third world countries. Whatever the case, I think that this kind of broad-based strategy is bound to be far more effective in reversing the devastating slide that Professor Sachs has so dramatically and lucidly portrayed that has occurred in these debtor countries in terms of their living standards, poverty, and the rise in infant mortality and so on. Finally, as a matter of an alternative view of this, I think one has to address systematically the question of the structure of the international financial system itself. And the question that has to be dealt with is what is going to be done to loosen the hold that the system as it is presently constituted, and by that I mean the fact which Professor Sachs indicated, that nine banks virtually rule the roost, so to speak, and this, by the way, supports the view that Professor Howard Wachtel has also portrayed in his book on the money mandarins, which is a felicitous expression for these nine banks plus the Eurodollar market. This issue of the structure of the financial system has not really been posed adequately, I think, in this discussion. And in fact, insofar as the position of knocking the banks borders on a purely moralistic argument about bank greed, it really misses the point that banks exist in a structure in which they have to function. They have to survive and grow. And their actions must then be interpreted as reasonably rational policies adopted in order to survive and grow in that structure. So the issue then becomes, what is the nature of the structure and how can it be changed and altered in order to accommodate the needs of third world countries? I'll pause at that point and allow for discussions.